is Visionary Activist Show. Stay tuned.
Context, Caroline Casey. So, yes, I am here kissing the mothership once again because I am off to co-MC and present at Gaia Festival this weekend. We will be joined and later in the show by Wavy Gravy, my co-cohorter, great sacred clown who will exhort us to pitch because we are offering, you know, we are in fund drive, yes. We're offering two pairs of full weekend, including camping, passes to the Gaia Festival with camping August 5th through 7th, Blackout Ranch in Laytonville. And that's two pairs for a pledge of $300 per pair, credit card only. And we'll be joined at the end. And as you know, we also the wild card, I will be offering an astrological reading to convene the full council of you, guiding you to contribute your medicine to the metastory of the crisis and beauty of now. And that's the wild card pledge for $1,000. Only one. There we go. And I will be bringing in moments our splendid guest, Derek Jensen, whose book, Dreams, is invaluable and pertinent for many reasons that we will explore. And that's for a pledge of $120. And you know, you can call 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732 or pledge online at kpfa.org. All you podcast allies out there and webcast people out there. Hello, Japan and Hawaii and Australia and South Africa and the Midwest and Boston and all of that. Hello. So briefly, before I bring in our guest, you know, it is pertinent, more than perfect to have Derek with us because, you know, in the guiding meta story in which we say, let metaphor be an incarnational garb whereby power enters the world. And let us think of and remember that mythic figures are metaphoric animations of intrinsic intelligence in nature. And we go, yes. So tonight at 8:11 p.m., Neptune, representing the principle of dreams and vision and our capacity to collaborate with, you know, co-dreaming the world into being, Neptune will station, appear to stand still from the Earth's perspective, beaming down this intelligence of dreaming and that we are all kin in one large pulsing dream. And then Neptune will retrograde at 8:11 p.m. back into Aquarius, the community defined in its largest sense as not just humans. You know, we say, may the hubris of humanism be eclipsed by the truth of democratic animism. You know, we're all in this thing together, and cooperators are standing by, and we'll dive into the realm of fungi and intrinsic intelligence, before which we should be humbled appropriately as a species. So, the last time, our great ally Sylvia Scully reminds me that Neptune was at this particular realm was a great brewing of spiritualism and talking to ancestors and everything, 1828 in this country. We go, yes. So Neptune also is appropriate to grieve the abundance of life on this planet we have grievously squandered by outsourcing our leadership to sociopaths. Bless their hearts that their hearts may bloom again. But we inhale back autonomy and leadership and look to nature and the wolves for appropriate models of leadership. We know that wolves don't operate on dominance, they operate on charisma. And in wolf culture, charisma means who initiates play best, who draws upon the ingenuity of the pack. And we go, excellent, let us take our model from that. So the slaughter of wolves is really, again, literally and metaphorically, the slaughtering of our wise teacher, guides, our co-evolutionary allies, without whom we would be nothing. Similarly, with the mushrooms that we'll get to. So absolutely, at this Lammas tide of rededication, we want to magnetize to the center of public discourse the healing of human relationships to the rest of creation and to all of our kin with whom we share this dynamic, fecund, once fecund mother planet ocean. Again, to heal the sociopathic disregard in which we have been complicitous. So I love, Ally says, you can't cajole or fight or discipline or bomb or anything other people or ourselves to do the right thing, but we can see them connected to their wise navigational autonomy. You know, so absolutely we want to play with this. Derek Jensen, I was inspired to invite him back on radio, reading a beautiful piece that he'd written, and below that, some ignorant dingbat, bless their hearts, had written, well, if he's into dreaming and everything, he must not have suffered much or dive very deeply into the crisis of now. I'm like, oh, you have no idea. This is our agent Captain Dark. This is our Navigate the Dark Waters ally, Derek Jensen, who has earned the right for blessing and power, because those who go to the underworld and make it back contribute their medicine of cooperating with nature's resilience. So Derek Jensen is known as the voice of the deep ecology movement. He's winner of numerous awards and honors, which we love. He's the author of over 15 books, Go Productivity, including Endgame, A Language Older Than Words, Beautiful, Beautiful, What We Leave Behind, and Deep Green Resistance, which is like, philosopher, teacher, and dedicated advocate for life. He does stir packed auditoriums across the country with revolutionary spirit. That's great. Holds degree in creative writing and mineral engineering physics, and I know he's also taught in prisons. Welcome, Derek.
Hey, thanks for having me, and thanks for your work.
Yeah, well, thank you. And let's address the dark for, more than a moment, because I want to be like the Dalai Lama, but it is the shooting of wolves and people who say, well, there's plenty of wolves, that will bring up in me, they're like, well, there's plenty of humans too, boom, or the ghost dog character in that great movie who takes out the hunters who shot the bear irreverently. But then, if we did that, we'd be back in the stupid ending of Avatar, the movie, wouldn't we? I mean, so are you... Do you feel your strategy is evolving, as evidenced by this beautiful book, Dreams, into, again, amplifying our strategies?
Well, I perhaps this is a bit blasphemous in this conversation, but the main problem I had with the ending of Avatar is that they let the industrialized humans leave.
Yeah,
I think what is primary is stopping this culture from killing the oceans, from killing the salmon, from killing the wolves. And you've mentioned you've mentioned the wolves a couple of times. It reminds me of a great story I've heard a few times about how maybe 100 years after the Europeans arrived on this continent, the indigenous peoples of the Northeast were recognizing that they were slaughtering wolves, and they had a big get-together to figure out, why are they doing this? There must be some reason. And they talked for several days and tried to come up with a good reason for them to, and let's try to understand what they're doing. And the only thing they could come up with at the end of the several days was, they're insane. It doesn't make any sense to kill the wolves, just as it makes no sense to kill the oceans. I mean, there are stolid scientists at this point who are saying that the oceans could be devoid of fish in 50 years, and the response is, along the lines of either drill, baby, drill, or let's see how the San Diego Padres do tonight. It's really extraordinary as we sleepwalk our way toward the end of the world.
I know, I just want to chime in going, until now, just by the power of language, without wanting to be too perky, but yes, keep going, sorry.
so there's, I guess that one of the places that I would like to a little bit respond to is the thing you said in the introduction about the person who wrote and said that addressing dreams must mean nothing bad has happened, because that's actually one of the reasons that I didn't write this book 5 or 6 books ago.
Right.
Is because I was, for years I've been being told by the muse, and well, we can talk about that in a second if you want.
Yes.
I've been told by the muse to write this book about dreams, and I kept putting it off. And one of the reasons I kept putting it off is because as the world is being murdered, you know, I don't have time to write a book about dreams. I've got to write a book about bringing down civilization. I've got to write a book about, you know, all these other things to try to help build a resistance movement. And then finally, you know, I consider myself to be kind of intelligent, because it only takes me, you know, 5 years of making a mistake before I stop making it, you know, or 50 times of making a mistake before I might think about stopping making it. And finally, I realized that there is something more to this. And one of the things is, for many years, you know, so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the land as a metaphor as opposed to the way the world really is. So that they perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. And there's a great line by this Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, you're going to treat them like dollar bills. You're going to treat them as something to, as a resource, as something to be used up. And on the other hand, if you perceive trees as trees, then you will treat them differently. The same is true for women. If I perceive women as orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If I perceive women as women, I'll treat them another way. If I perceive this particular woman as this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. This is the same all across the board. And now the way this comes back to dreams is that also, I mean, that seems pretty clear to me, that relationship. And the relationship between perceiving the world as consisting of resources and killing it seems pretty clear also.
Right.
And then there's another thing, too, which is, and this is what finally really caused me to write the book, is that indigenous peoples have generally also talked at length about having relationships with ancestors, with, you know, spirits, with... It's like I asked an indigenous friend one time, Jeanette Armstrong, Okanagan Indian, where dreams come from. And she laughed and said, everybody knows the animals give them to us.
Right.
And then I asked Vine Deloria a couple of years later.
I love him.
Great writer.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's wonderful. I asked him where dreams come from, and he said, well, the spirits give them to us. And I said, well, Jeanette says it's animals. And he started laughing, and he said, well, of course she'd say that, because she's up more from the Pacific Northwest, where there's a lot more forest, and your entire cosmology will be around how do you maintain psychic integrity when you have all these beings who are hitchhiking. You know, we'll step away from that for a second. So the point is that I live right now on Talawa land, on Talawa Indian land, and the Talawa lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science. And they lived here since the beginning of time, if you believe the myths of the Talawa. In either case, they lived here a long time. They didn't destroy the place. And the European culture, the dominant culture, the civilization has been here for 180 years, and the place is now trashed. And so the question becomes, but the Talawa didn't not destroy the place because they were too stupid to invent backhoes. You know, they didn't destroy the place quite probably for other reasons having to do with their cosmology, with how they perceive the world. And so if we're asking for, at this stage in the murder of the planet, I think we need to look for allies wherever we can find them. And I think we need to look at everything about this culture. And one of the things about this culture, another way to put this, to sort of jump aside, and anybody who's read any of my books know that I jump all over the place anyway, is that I have tried and tried and tried, and also talked to a lot of indigenous people, and I've never heard of an atheistic indigenous culture. I've never heard of an indigenous culture that doesn't believe, that isn't animistic, that doesn't believe that the entire world is filled with...
Right.
With life and divinity.
And I just want to bring in the Thai saying,
right.
Because we were never colonized, we never lost our animism. And I think that's really crucial, that we've been taught to be ashamed of what we should be most proud, our multi-availability kinship, and people on our team or whatever go, "Everybody's a spirit hoser," and you go, "Well, that's the colonized mind," you know. And to break that colonization within and without is crucial. And then Sir Herbert Reed chimes in and says, "Only those serving an apprenticeship to nature can be trusted with machines." We go, "Yes, let's put this on our work table." Absolutely. Cooperators are standing by, that it's perfect that we've created such a horrific and murderous pickle that we cannot resolve this by ourselves as humans, but only by cooperating, which is wherever you want to go is fine, but we want to go also to our mutual ally, Paul Stamets, and the humbling ingenuity of the fungi and your beautiful, beautiful chapters on the history of the earth. Those are so fantastic. I cannot encourage everyone, because we do kill what we don't know about and therefore don't respect. So knowing more the history, and you delineate the and remind us of the glorious fecundity which we will not know, you know, of skies covered with birds, and I mean all of that. We go, yes. So we owe it to the team to do all we can by cooperating with this ingenuity. Yeah.
Well, there's a couple things about that. One of them, and thank you for saying all that, and one of them is that there's something that hit me a couple 3 years ago as I was writing What We Leave Behind with Eric McBay, that how did the world get to be so wild and fecund and beautiful in the first place? And it, you know, we're taught, and you know, the first person, you keep using the word cooperation, and the first time I encountered the notion that natural selection may be based primarily on cooperation as opposed to competition was through the writings of John Livingston. And I interviewed him like 1992. And he said, you know, he said outright that he believes that natural selection is based on primarily on cooperation, long-term intraspecific cooperation. I love that. But at the time, I was thinking, he's crazy. Everybody knows it's based on competition, because it's what I've been taught my whole life, you know, that evolution is based on survival of the fittest, and which means the meanest, which means the most capitalistic, which means the better you can exploit, the better you survive. But that's so crazy. I can show that is not true in one sentence if you give me a couple semicolons, which is, those creatures have survived in the long run, We would agree with that. Semicolon. And you don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You actually survive in the long run by making your habitat better. And that's what salmon do. And that's what redwood trees do. And that's what passenger pigeons used to do. And that's what chestnut trees do. And it's what everybody does.
And wolves.
Wolves do.
Wolves do it.
You actually, I love this line by Dolores LaChapelle. It's not survival of the fittest. It's survival of the fit, which is how well you fit into your habitat.
Yes.
Because it's pretty obvious that, let's put this numerically for a second, that say your habitat's health, 100 is good and 0 is terrible. And let's say it's at 100, and then next year it's at 99, and the year after it's 98, and then the year after it's 97. Eventually, anybody who is not an economist can understand that eventually it's going to get to 0. And that's not, how do we think the world got to be so beautiful in the first place? It got to be so beautiful by bears and wolves and salmon and human beings just living and dying and doing what they do, and each one making the world a little bit better place, the physical world. I'm not talking about making the world a better place by writing poetry, although poetry is great. I'm talking about, well, poetry might, that's a bad example. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about pooping in the forest, you know, and that helps make soil. I'm talking about the world. I don't even, it's embarrassing even to have to try to explain what I mean by that. Just making the world a better place, making it so the salmon,
well, we do.
The salmon make trees a better place simply by their existence. And the trees make salmon a better place by, the trees give salmon a better place to live by their, did you know, it's pretty cool. Did you know that trees release certain hormones in the spring to wake up fish?
Oh, no, I didn't know that part. I was going to go somewhere else. Say that.
That in the spring, in the fall, in the fall, trees release certain hormones that get into the streams that will cause fish to, you know, get a little sleepy for a few months. And then in the spring, they release hormones that make them more active. It's not hibernation. It's just, you know, chilling out. And, you know, we're all working together. There's, back to John Livingston, this long-term intraspecific cooperation. So, and if you want to go to fungus, we can, or we can go wherever you want with that.
No, that's right. No, let's just for a moment to chime in here, because another mean trick of the reality police is the word compete actually means to strive together. Again, it's been kidnapped from us. And what I thought you were going to say about the trees, but I love that, that's great new ancient information, is that also trees, again, we bow before their intelligence. When they're being munched on by an insect, they have a certain boundary going, that's okay, that you've crossed the line. And then at that point, they release pheromones that attract the predator of that insect. Oh, it's so smart. Well, at the same time, sending out a pheromone to other trees, going, rude guys are coming, start making this thing. So we go, oh, it's so fabulous. Now, cooperators are standing by, yes, because at the same time as Darwin, who is a lot more complex than what he's been, you know, forced into servitude for justifying, but at the same time was the anarchist Kropotkin, the biological, you know, who said mutual aid and reciprocal blessing is how we get, yeah, exactly, as you said. And I just wanted to also just give us another image of these fabulous things. And so once when snorkeling, somebody said, you've got to come see this. And it was two feeder fish facing each other. And then between them was a long line of fish lined up, predators, barracuda, and those fish that they would eat and everything, lined up peacefully and slowly swimming between these two fish who would then clean them from lice. And then they'd swim off, and then the next fish would swim in between them. It was adorable. And we go, anyway, so those things that make us proud to be alive and to go more like that. And in that respect, you know, maybe we do want to go to, you know, one of your most, well, there are many beautiful chapters in Dreams, but one of the most beautiful also, which includes the history of the earth and the die-offs and everything, is the chapter on fungi. So maybe we want to introduce, you know, say hello to the fungi and go, we are willing to cooperate with you, and anything you want to bring up about Paul Stamets, who will be co-presenting at the Gaia Festival this weekend. And you can have a pair of tickets for $300 to the Gaia Festival, where Wavy Gravy and me and Sherry Glazer and Aaron Neville and a million people and Paul Stamets will be. And that's by calling 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. Yes, back to you, Derek Jensen.
Paul, it's kind of ironic or kind of weird, but for years people have been telling me I had to read Mycelium Running,
yes,
by Paul Stamets. And the thing that's ironic or contrary or something is the recommendations were so high that I put it off for a couple of years because it's like, it can't be as good as everybody's saying. I know that sounds kind of stupid.
Well, no, it's like a bestseller book. You know, it's like, no.
Yeah, exactly. Whatever. So finally I read it, and it really was as good as everybody said. It's, you know, everybody says, oh my God, this book changed my life. And in this case, it did. It changed everything about how I perceive the world. And, you know, I've been a forest activist for 20 years, and I live in a forest. I poop in a forest. I've protected forests. I've done all this stuff. I love forests. Forests help me write, you know. But the thing is, for 20 years, I had been entirely misperceiving forests because I always thought that, yeah, of course, there's newts and there's salamanders and there's gnats and everybody else. But I always thought, you know, what makes a forest is trees. But he helped me understand that really the defining creature, if we have to set one apart, which of course is inimical to everything we're talking about, but we'll do it anyway for a second, that fungus are kind of fungus help define forests, even though we don't see them for the most part. And a great example is there's a single oyster mushroom up in Oregon that is, I'm making up the numbers, like 4,000 acres, or it's huge.
But it's the largest living organism in the world.
It's absolutely immense. And it's also been living there for thousands and thousands of years. And what they've found is that not only do the fungi live a long time and get big and everything else, but they also help act in the interests, long-term interests of the forest. And a really small example of this is that people wondered how small trees in the middle of a forest would survive on the lack of light. And they would take a tree out and they would put it into a greenhouse and then control the light so it only got the same amount, and it would die every time. And then what they found is that the mycelial network, the network of the fungus, would take energy. The fungus is like connected to every tree, and it would take energy from the trees who were by a stream and had access to a lot more light. It would take energy from them, and it would give them, and take nutrients from them, and it would give those nutrients to the trees in the dark to help them grow. And that's pretty, that was pretty mind-blowing for me.
That's pretty fabulous, yeah. Well, because what you mentioned in the book, Dreams, is that where there's a surplus, they will distribute it. Again, let's have this be our economy to that which needs it, because surplus is toxic to the, you know, give the surplus and the mycelia kind of the underworld intelligence network, you know, and they really do. You know, when we speak about underworld, like, oh, it means the soil, it means the mycelia, to journey to the underworld for, you know, it is that which metabolizes poison, and as you and Stamets animate for us, the truth that they will collect toxins, including radioactivity. They can't metabolize the radioactivity, but they can collect it, you know, and
well, actually, it ends up, it's even better than that, because I don't know if this is in the book, I might have learned this since then. They found a mold, a fungus, growing inside of the containment systems
in Chernobyl
that is actually metabolizing the radioactive energy. That's actually what it's eating.
Right, but the way I understood it from Stamets is that, because Stamets is an unabashed animist, and again, it's the time when, you know, unabashed animists can get Department of Defense contracts, no problem. So it's like, everybody, you know, your pragmatic mystic self, welcome, come on out. It will not damage your reputation. It'll only enhance it. And so he talks to the mushrooms, and he will say that when talking to grown ups, you know, grown up government scientists, I talk to the mushrooms, and they're like, whatever, if it works, you know, what the hell. But the way years ago I said, you know, what about radioactivity? He goes, nothing can metabolize that, but the little guys are working on it. We're putting in a request, you know, again, this call and response. And then he did mention later, he said, now they've evolved. They're working on it because they know they got to help us out to save the planet, you know. And he said that they are growing giant mushrooms in Chernobyl, and yes, the mold that you mentioned, which is cool. And my understanding, although there might be, again, breakthroughs as we speak right now, because the little guys are working on it, the little people, the invisible underworld metabolizes their poison. So he said that they could, you know, collect it, which is why he's got a great kind of plan for Japan, of, you know, wood chips, you know, from all the damage, and then these mushrooms from Chernobyl, which will attract and spare fields, but you still gotta, you know, then move in hazmat suits and take the mushroom remnants and take them away and burn them and then store them in glass containers forever. So that's my, but maybe they're actually metabolizing it into something like the oyster mushrooms completely metabolize the diesel oil. So maybe they have. All right, let, you know, we're up for that. So, yes, and I love, you know, I love, yeah, Vine Deloria was a great and honored ally, buddy. We talked to, he would want his spirit talked to. I mean, he would say, you know, and when I'm gone, you know, call my spirit in. And I love your quote of him. You say, he says, Aboriginal groups have never had any need for a messiah. Yes, not only is there no need, but in fact, there's really no place for one in the cosmos. And we go, yeah, the whole idea of a chosen people or a messiah, you know, into Pluto's underworld fungal cauldron. So we love that. So does the healing of the sense that we humans have to figure this out on our own, we certainly have to wake up, but that sense of partnership with everything rooting for us, if we just are willing to rejoin the community, I mean, do you feel more heartened, like against all odds, but we can do this? Or just give it a try anyway, you know?
Well, of course. And there's the hesitation I'm having is the word heartened, because mm-hmm. I mean, things are bad.
Yes.
And what I know is that the muse who speaks to me is as worried and is working. One reason I write so much is because my muse is very frightened. And if writing does any good whatsoever, then I need to be, she and I want to get it out as much and as quickly as we can. And I don't know, and I can't present a future scenario. I can't present. I'm not particularly I don't know what's going to come. It will take some sort of a miracle, and the only miracle we're going to get is us, by which I don't mean just us. I mean us working in, as you're saying, with the what do you call them, co-collaborators?
Cooperators are standing by.
Yeah. It's with that. But you're exactly right. They're standing by. I mean, one reason I write so much is because I have made myself available to and put myself in the service of, and I we can talk about whether, you know, the hierarchy inherent in the service of, but that's not what's really what's important right this second, of the muse. And a story that I tell sometimes, which is actually true, is that back in 1997, I had a Madison Avenue agent, and I was writing a language older than words, and the address of the agency was 1 Madison Avenue, and they have an entire floor. They had an entire floor there. And this was, I mean, it's a huge literary agency, very prestigious. And I sent her the first 70 pages of A Language Older Than Words, and my agent said if I took out the social criticism and the family stuff that I would have a book. And I fired her that day. And, you know, I was in therapy for 12 years about the abusive childhood I had. The only day I ever cried in therapy was the day that I fired my agent, because I thought that I'd always wanted to be a writer, and I thought I'd destroyed my career even before it started. But in retrospect, it was the best decision I ever made, and the muse has rewarded me greatly for that loyalty.
Exactly. And it's like the chant friends left, you know, don't you be so sad and blue, you've got the muse looking after you. So,
yeah.
You know, so, yeah, no, that's what I mean. Cooperators are standing by. They do require being invited and welcomed to cooperate, because that's part of the meta story of now, of which you are an invaluable contributing teammate, you know, is okay, here's collapse and just horrific that we need to know. My plane mate on the plane out here yesterday, back to the mothership, I've talked to, you know, Cisco systems people, and I've talked to military intelligence people bombing things, and I've talked to, you know, Northrop Grumman guy, and we could always find some liberating accord somewhere. But I had a confident young, you know, venture capitalist who said, do you know what venture capitalists are? And I go, yes, I lied. And I said, ingenious solutions, that's what you should do. And, oh, there's no money in that thing, you know. And there's no evidence at all that fracking pollutes water. And I'm like, oh, I need my inner Derek Jensen here. But it wasn't, so, you know, blessings to him. But the meta story that we want to alert, and it is, you know, is here's what's going down, you know, but like in nature, you know, some seeds only bloom after cataclysm, you know, the forest fire or whatever. And by analogy, some part of our willingness to cooperate with nature's evolutionary ingenuity only comes alive, you know, like, now would be good, you know, like, so, and it's that part that is, you know, that you delineate beautifully in Dreams, that, you know, these sparks of just, you know, mad, ingenious life experimentation, just boom, and we go, yes, a cultural and natural participatory renaissance wants to happen, and we don't deny the horror. We need that, and again, you are an invaluable teammate at going, did you know? You know, and then amplifying our learning from our natural allies, well, how do we metabolize poison, and how do we deepen our dedication to cooperating, you know, ingeniously? So, you know, there's no future in nihilism, you know, so it's like, all right, let's, you know, there's a kind of not denial, but plucky part of nature that is in us that I think is coming alive. So heartened, I think it's good. Heart is kinship realm, but no, you don't, yeah.
I also want to, yeah, I love what you're saying, and I want to also just, there's something, I don't remember exactly what it was you said, but there's something that was really sparking in me about that, about, I mentioned the muse earlier.
Yes.
And, you know, I watched this, this TED talk a few months ago with, I don't remember her name, it's the woman who wrote the
Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah, actually. And one of the things she said in there, which I didn't know, I mean, when I talk about the muse, or I talk about the dream giver, like, Dreams is the only book I've ever seen, actually, ever, that is about, in some ways, dream interpretation that doesn't take dreams. It's the only Western book, I should say. It's the only sort of European book that takes dreams not as dream interpretation, not as messages from the unconscious, but instead as messages from somewhere else. Or someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And there's plenty in other traditions, but I don't see many in this tradition. And to go back to the Eat, Pray, Love woman, a I was watching this TED Talk maybe 6 months or a year ago where she was saying that it's only since really the Enlightenment, and this is not a nice bit of propaganda, by the way, only since the so-called Enlightenment that people in the West have perceived artists as creating their own work. And up until then, it was absolutely standard that people would believe that the muse gave them, a muse gave them their art, or their, you know, their visual art, their writing, whatever. And just the notion that we have to create everything on our own is an incredibly lonely and destructive, you use the word meta-narrative, that's an extremely destructive meta-narrative, the notion that it's us against the universe,
yeah,
as opposed to the notion that, honestly, when I get stuck writing, I just take a walk, and there are certain groups of trees, I don't know which tree or if it's a group of trees, but I know there are certain places that when I walk by them, if I'm stuck, they give me answers.
Yes.
And there are other places where it works, too. I don't, you know, and I say that, and it's like all the other trees in the forest are going, hey, we help, too.
right.
But there are some specific places that are especially, that I can hear especially well. I mean, I'm going to go ahead and I'm not going to put the responsibility onto them, because maybe everybody's speaking and I can't hear. You know, I don't know what it is, but for to make it value neutral, there are some places where I walk by where the ideas come easily.
Yes, no, and also last week's wonderful guest and my future collaborator this weekend, Susie Barsotti, what endeared me is that she was having problems with wood rats who were, you know, eating important plants. And she said, I don't really know how to speak to wood rat, but I do know how to speak to deer, so I asked the deer to speak to the wood rat. We go, yeah. And the whole realm of dreams and fairy tales, kind of like an originating, guiding thing, all of which have been dissed and all of which we need. In the Arthurian legends, you know, it is the metaphor absolutely of the muse, and Sir Balin and Sir Balin are given the fairy sword and the gift of eloquence, but they must remember that it is not from them. They must not claim credit for it. And in the end, when the fairy realm, the invisible realm, says, now hand back these gifts we gave you to help save the world, and they're like, no, and they go, oh, it's not going to go well for you. You will kill the thing. You will kill the thing you love most, and they do. They end up killing themselves. But it's that model that these are loaned to us and borrowed, you know, and it's a deal. Use this for greater good, but do not claim credit because it's a it's a cooperator standing by kind of thing, and hand it back when necessary. And I think these are true, useful. The reason I also, you know, feel that heartened is the way to go, fully informed about the horrible everything, heartened. But it's, you know, unless we've done everything to offer ourselves to, we are willing to be agents of collaborative ingenuity and open the path for us, and, you know, this experimental, you know, not expecting or whatever, but willingness as dance partner of life, unless we've done all of that, we have just no right to be kind of, and again,
I totally agree. And my hesitation is not based on my hesitation with, and I don't disagree with the word heartened. I'm just, my hesitation has to do with, not with the willingness of those on other sides, but my hesitation has to do with two things. One of them is that I don't know that if, I mean, the muse needs my cooperation because she doesn't have an opposable thumb to write. I mean, she doesn't have a body. So we have to cooperate in order to affect a change in the real world. In the material world. And, if we had the numbers of people, of human people who were willing to enter into these relationships that you and I are talking about, then we wouldn't even have to worry about fracking because we would stop it.
Yes, well, right. Well, this is, again, I think what really wants to happen, you know, and again, the offering of our humble collaborative selves going, use us in any way, oh muse, and it is wheel and deal, you know, I've got a thumb, you've got a vision, let's go,
exactly.
You know, and to and fro, which is complete. I live with a coyote, an actual coyote, you know, so I'm always learning. It's nothing to do about shame or discipline. It's telepathic cutting deals. I give you this, and you do that thing. All right. And that's completely how to work with Coyote. I mean, literal Coyote, and the trickster energy going, all right, you do this. You know, here we go. You're giving up this domain of freedom. You get this in return. I'm giving it, you know. So that idea of, you know, brokering, the true spiritual marketplace is not a kind of reducing everything to money, but it is, you know, a collaborative reciprocal blessing. How can we thrive better together? But, We must think of this as part one, Derek Jensen, because you have so much to contribute. I must now move to the pitching. Please, team, send money to Pacifica KPFA and support this show. Do you want to stay and meet Wavy Gravy on the phone?
Actually, I need to run, but
okay.
Two things. One is I would love to do this again.
Yes.
And the second is, so I will give a quick pitch. So
yes.
Call in and send money to KPFA so we have non-corporate radio things we can listen to.
And as you are, again, invaluable teammates, so that we move this conversation about cooperating, healing our relationship to the world, you know, and to the center of public discourse, because it's from the war on life is the war on, you know. So, yes, absolutely. We want to move this conversation into the center of the memosphere. But thank you so much for your work, Derek Jensen.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for yours.
Okay, great. Absolutely. Okay, there goes our ally, Derek Jensen, and here comes our ally, Wavy Gravy. Is that possible? Cooperators standing by? Yes.
You have gravy in your ear, perhaps a Q-tip.
That's very cute. So, yes, I'm about to meet your beloved by everyone in the world, sacred clown self, and I'm grateful you're coming on to pitch our wonderful upcoming Gaia Festival, for which we have a pair of weekend passes for a pledge of 300. That's actually less than retail. Only two pair, credit card only. But yes, feel free to exhort, Wavy. Let me give the numbers out. You can have that pair of weekend passes or Derek Jensen's book Dreams, which is really pretty great. When I was grumpy, I opened to only the grumpy sections of the book, but then when I was heartened, I turned into these fabulous sections of the book, and that's for a pledge of $120 and astrological reading with me, which will completely unleash you on the world for $1,000. 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732 or online kpfa.org. It's particularly important, you know, this is the only Visionary Activist Show pledge, because next week we're preempted by something undoubtedly wonderful. But it's really good to show your support for this conversation, for this quality of Renaissance emerging. So, yes, Wavy, how would you like to guide, exhort, or just encourage us to frolic in any way?
Well, I would like to tell people about the Gaia Festival and what's going to be happening tune-wise. The incredible India Ari is going to be performing Galactic from New Orleans, also from New Orleans. Aaron Neville, and then from Jamaica, the Mighty Diamonds and the Wailers, also from New Orleans, the Funky Meters, from Jamaica, Sister Carol. Just so many amazing performers, and at the same time, great the speakers. My God, John Trudell is going to be there, one of the great Native American activists and founders of the American Indian Movement, and a brilliant poet who, at one time, Bob Dylan said he had the best rock and roll band in America. Of course, that's when Jesse Ed Davis was still around, God rest his soul. But also, the wonderful workshops, Oren Lyons is going to be there from the East Coast. He's the chief Oren Lyons.
Exactly.
He's in Onondaga. They're having a medicine wheel lounge and a women's herbal symposium. All kinds of awesome stuff.
That's great. Shout out to Susie Barsotti. Now, this is a festival about which I have complete, unconflicted enthusiasm. The timing, the likes of yourself, the wonderful, rich cultural Renaissance contributors that you mentioned. Yes, Jamaica, New Orleans, the medicine of these places, and John Trudell, those who've been to different difficult places and come back. So let me further say, yes, the Gaia Festival weekend pass with camping completely August 5th through 7th. That's tomorrow. So you got to, you know, be an intuitive responder at Black Oak Ranch, Laytonville, about 3 hours north of San Francisco. Only two pairs, credit card only, by calling 510 510- 1-800-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or online, hello, kpfa.org. And you can also get Derek Jensen's really useful book so that you can be an informed, did you know about this? And here's this thing. And, you know, and he's inching towards, we wouldn't say optimism, but he's inching towards, you know, pragmatic mysticism. There we go. That's for a pledge of $120. And then astrological reading with me, wild card. You can pay over months, you know, $1,000 pledge. We converse on the phone and fully unleash you on the world. All of those things. And then just to come back to your great sacred clown self, Wavy, because we have not met in person yet. But everywhere I go, people go, everyone in the world loves Wavy Gravy. And we go, yeah, so just, you know, bask in that. Everyone loves you. That's just the word on the street from even the grumpiest of people. Oh, Wavy Gravy.
I've been basked and I've been baked and I'm just returning from the East Coast where I do the Gathering of the Vibes. That was with Elvis Costello and Susan Tedeschi and Derek Trucks and Levon Helm and a whole lot of other folks. But the Gaia Fest is on our own spread where I do a children's camp for over 30 years called Camp Winter Rainbow, a circus and performing arts camp. And I'll be running back and forth on Friday and Saturday, and then Sunday I'll be all Gaia.
All Gaia, all the time. And it may be of a perpetual spiral. That's great. And then there are people, I don't know, there's a friend of mine, Tom Werner, that we had in the fullness of time, who does Clowns Without Borders, that I want you to cahoot. We go, oh, because he...
Oh, Mr. Yoo-Hoo, yes. He is taught here, and he also works with Bernie Glassman, who
yes.
has taken clowns to some of the most frightening places on the planet.
They're going to Macau,
for instance.
Yeah, and Somalia and Afghanistan. And I don't know if you've seen him do this great thing where he has a balloon and he says, if we cooperate with each other, and then he puts a knitting needle all the way through the balloon and it doesn't pop, and he goes, if we cooperate, you know, this is it, but if we don't, and then he flicks it and it explodes, boom, then the world will be like this, you know, which is great. And the kids, you know, again, love that, if we cooperate. And so you've been, I'm so glad that I don't need to introduce you because you're connected to everybody. Splendid.
Just become an actual movie that is now about to burst onto DVD this fall. It's been playing in selected cities all over the country for the last, at least year and a half, it seems. And now we're going on Showtime, and it's going out on DVD. So,
yes.
They've changed the name of it
from
Saint Misbehavin' to the Wavy Gravy Movie, and then subtitled Saint Misbehavin'.
Oh, all right.
So apparently, they need to, the powers that be, whoever the producers are, said, you gotta put the clown up front. So, whatever.
Well, that's great that you are a bigger market draw than, Saints. As it should be. That's completely right. So that's great. So you can see Wavy Gravy and myself, periodically, and, I'll be presenting at 6 p.m. in the Longhouse on Saturday, and hilariously fabulous, co-hoder, Sherry Glazer, and all the great musicians that Wavy will be introducing. I understand that's part of the schedule because you know them. You've earned the right to introduce these guys, all the people that you delineate, you know, John Trudell and the Jamaican medicine and New Orleans medicine and all those crucial things. So, and Paul Stamets will be there, and but the timing is so perfect because this is true Lammas. It is the exact middle of summer. It is the power, you know, when the community invites power in to animate the whole next stage of culture, and to determine where the money and commonwealth should go. So it's perfectly timed, you know. So either come literally or telepathically, what the hell, this is a powerful weekend. And we have only two pairs, generously donated by the likes of Wavy and Susie Barsotti, two pairs of full weekend passes with camping, with the whole thing, for a pledge of $300. Bless everyone's heart there. And that's by calling 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. So you could do that. You could get Derek Jensen's book for only $120. You could have an astrological reading with me for $1,000. in person, if you pledge for the weekend pass and me, what the hell, we'll fit it in somehow, or else it's on the phone. And again, you know, and you have all those things and wavy gravy and the richness that so many people have been working for so long to bring together this weekend, you know, as a great replenishment source that everyone's, you know, medicine maybe a bit more deeply dedicated, and with great fun we can participate as agents of emergent renaissance and be inspired by the likes of Wavy, who has been dedicated for so long. Yeah, because friends have seen the movie. I've not yet seen the movie. We wanted to offer it as DVD, but it's not available yet. But they do, you know, it goes into your journeys to Afghanistan so long ago, right?
It's going to be on the PBS station in the Bay Area this fall also, I've been told.
That's great. Yes, we want it to spiral forth.
That's very exciting. Also, I see there are going to be all these DJs at this Gaia Fest. DJ Jeb Sabah, DJ Dragonfly. I've seen her before, and she's extraordinary. DJ Drum Spider and DJ Shaman Dream. Holy moly.
Yeah, and in one of the nights, there's a dedicated Middle Eastern music theme. I go, now we're talking, not some loud, techno, horrible, alienating thing. Middle Eastern, full of yearning. Oh, yes, and ecstatic dancing. Ecstatic self-loss is how we replenish in myriad ways. That's great. So it is a collaborative cahooting, and the reason also, just talking backstage to Susie Barsotti, that I decided this was the one thing I wanted to do this summer, because it was so crafted and dedicated and timed and synchronous and gathering of such good medicine, and again deeply dedicated, because like Pacifica, I mean, and like Wavy's work and like Gaia Festival, this is raising money to sustain itself, but that is not its purpose. It is raising money to sustain itself, but its purpose is cultural renaissance, and to have the conversations and the animated myth and the music and art to bring a culture alive. That's why we're doing it at this station, at KPFA, and also on this show, the Visionary Activist Show. And that's why Gaia Festival, with the, you know, many, many elves working so hard backstage to pull up the curtain for our, you know, incredible delight, this rich banquet of metaphors and music and human characters. So, yes, and I gather, I'm not hearing any spirit voices from the phone room, I gather we still have a pair. Oh, well, there's a slight voice. Yes?
That was me moaning.
Oh, it was you moaning? Okay.
I'm remembering that I have been doing stuff with Pacifica for half a century, since the 60s, when I used to go on Bob Fass's show from midnight till dawn in the Cement Apple.
Ah.
Which is Gravy East for New York City.
That's wonderful.
Many times in Washington, D.C., but never in Texas, which is the one that was bombed, I do believe.
Yes. Well, early on, they have that distinction.
Early on, yeah.
They do have that distinction. Bless our teammates in Houston. We surround them with light and all of that. But yeah, no, I love that you've been, you know, an ally of Pacifica, of KPFA, you know, and we think, you know, teammates out there listening, you know, each, like Gaia is a presiding force and dedication for this upcoming festival weekend, of which we have two pairs of tickets for $300 pledge. You know, for each one. But Pacifica also a goddess of peace. Regardless of all of us dedicated and befoibled humans, there's something deeper to which we're dedicated that bypasses all the befoiblement, and it's to that to which we want you, dynamic, listening, best audience in world, to contribute, to the spirit of Pacifica, that we can keep having these conversations, to the spirit of Gaia, that we may participate in healing the world and humans coming back into dynamic and playful balance with everything else. Yes, so... So by calling, you know, you can have astrological reading with me for $1,000, you know, what the hell? And you can pay for that over a long time. You can have a pair of full full weekend passes with camping. Just, oh my God. August 5th through 7th, that's tomorrow, team. Black Oak Ranch in Laytonville, California, about 3 hours north of San Francisco. Again, for a pledge of 300. We only have two pairs of those. You know, so it's 300 for a pair, you lucky things. And Derek Jensen's really fantabulous book for a pledge of $120, again, by calling 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732 or pledging online, kpfa.org. And you'll notice, with Wavy and the likes of myself, we are not haranguing, we are not finger-wagging, we are magnetizing. That's it. We're magnetizing money and attendance and dreams. Yeah, so, yes, anything you want to say, Wavy, to, you know.
Even if it was only Aaron Neville, that would be enough. That would be enough. He will cause, if you've never heard Aaron Neville, your jaw will fall on the grass. It will just, is the most soul-wrenching, awesomely amazing entertainer, singer of songs that I have ever in all my life of rock and roll, from the beginnings of the folk revival till the eternity now, that I've never heard anything the likes of Aaron Neville.
Yoo-hoo. Oh. That's thrilling. That's thrilling. And also something very dear to Susie Barsotti's heart. Hello, Susie. Is the singing Down the Sun? Yes. Have you done this, Wavy? This.
No, but I'm prepared.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's that's great. So new things. Okay, you know, everybody, the whole, you know, however, it's a small festival, meaning, you know, like 4,000 people. Small. It's small enough. It's small enough to do seriously dedicated, playful juju. We'll be singing Down the Sun, just like prairie dogs, you know, and offering our cahoots with prairie dogs and the wood rats and the deer and the oceans and everything. So, you know, what are things that make us proud to be humans as opposed to appalled? Well, the work of Wavy Gravy. Yes, we feel prouder of that.
At camp, we have 300 kids go through here, 700 kids a summer, for the last over 30 years, and we've made this beautiful labyrinth with the children, and they walk it under the stars, and I tell them when they get to the center of the labyrinth to close their eyes, feel down through the soles of their feet, and there's an energy there which I call the spirit of Gaia, the Earth Mother, and if they have cares or problems, they can share them with her. Her arms are enormous, and many a young camper has walked out of that labyrinth lighter than they walked in.
Oh, that's perfect.
They do. They just float out of the labyrinth. It's not the labyrinth that you see at the Grace Cathedral, which is the Christian labyrinth that goes, I guess, from during the Crusades. People could not go to pilgrimage in Jerusalem, so they created these labyrinths that they walked on their knees, and the ones that in the Bay Area were taken from the cathedral at Chartres, and a wonderful woman, Lauren Artress, went there and traced the labyrinths and brought them back to the Grace Cathedral, where they're inlaid in the rug and then now outside, available 24/7. However, the labyrinth that we use is a pagan labyrinth, which goes back 3,000 years. I think the first one found on the island of Sardinia, and then through the British Isles, Scandinavia to Africa, to Peru, India. I first saw it at the Sun Temple in Mesa Verde. I was with staying with Hopi at that time, and I asked what this ideogram, what it was, and I was told, oh, Wavy Gravy, that's just the master plan of the universe. So I said, could I borrow your pen? And proceeded to, we created it in camp with the first spot that sunlight falls on the property, and I drew it out with knots in a rope and blue cornmeal, and each year for the last, 20 years, we have added rocks and flowers, and it's lined with river sand so that the children walk it in their bare feet.
That's excellent. We're almost on our way out, and I gotta spin that to contributing to Pacifica KPFA is like walking that pagan labyrinth. And yes, absolutely, connecting to the earth, how fantastic, and the 3,000-year-old labyrinth. So everything literal, everything metaphoric. You know, call in now, team, 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732 or online kpfa.org. Thank you so much, Wavy. I'll see you this weekend. Yay.
TheGaiaFestival.com.
There we go, TheGaiaFestival.com. And thanks so much to Carla West, our ally in Berkeley, and to the whole team here. I'm so proud of KPFA, and to Freewill and Franklin, who's on his birthday vacation. Hello. I'm Caroline Casey. See you at Gaia Festival, literally or telepathically, and we will reconvene. Well, not next week, because we're preempted. This is the only time to pledge to the Visionary Activist Show. This pledge time. All right, we're in cahoots.
You're listening to KPFA 94.1 FM, and this is our summer fun drive. And if you have any free time, come on down to 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley and help us answer the phones. Or feel free to donate at 1-800-439-5732 or 510-848-5732.
You're listening to KPFA Berkeley, KPFB Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2:59. Up now, Book Waves on Cover to Cover. Stay tuned.